right. I am here in this episode with Brad Robeson, who I honestly feel like I already know because I had a glowing review the first time, like, you have to meet this guy. His background is so cool. He's done so much good and is just incredibly smart. So I was like, okay, see, I'm a believer. But it was just rave reviews about you. So I'm so, so excited that you're here. So Brad's currently the owner and president of Clean Machine, which is a precision component machine shop. It's in West Jordan. He also serves on a number of different boards. He serves on in the Salt Lake Chamber, National Tooling and Machining Association, and the Utah Manufacturers Association. Prior to Clean Machine, he had a super successful career, NCI.
Correct.
And that was for 28 years.
Yes, it was.
And then you have to tell me and then you moved to a different company. What is the name of that company?
Balin Manufacturing. I was actually a consultant.
Okay.
On a turnaround project for them.
And that was a good chunk of time too. That was 7 years, not 28, but 7 years.
It was actually about 5 years active and I still serve on their board.
Nice. Awesome. And then just in addition to all of that, I know that you are an incredible leader in the manufacturing space, visionary person, just an incredible person to know if you're in manufacturing in Utah. So I don't normally do this, but we have to go back with you. We got to go back because I heard some stories and I need to hear them from the mouth. But we need to go back to when I think it was after high school, right? Where you're kind of launching into the rest of your life, your career, and your dad seems like a very cool guy. And I need to know more about what did he have you do and how did that kind of set you off for the future?
Well, we're actually going to go back further than
further.
High school.
Okay, let's go back as far as we need to go.
I first of all want to say, you know, what I'm going to talk about hopefully resonates in the way I intend to, which is really a tribute to those who challenged me, gave me the opportunities they did, and then supported me along the way. And so I couldn't be sitting here having this conversation without that. And my objective, which you'll hear about later, is to really pay that back.
I love that. So, thank you for setting us up with that.
Let's go all the way back to when I was 12.
When you were born.
I was 12 years old. When I was 12 years old, my father sat me down and he challenged me. He said, I want you to go to college, but I'm not paying for it. Now, I had two older brothers that I know didn't get that challenge. But I accepted that. He obviously, well, he wasn't obvious. He gave me some choices. And he said, you can go to college, but I want you to pay for it. And here's how you can do that. And he handed me these two phone book size. I'm talking big city phone books, if you remember what those were like. Mm-hmm. And that one was for scholarships and one was for grants. And he said, you can be a good student or you can play athletics and you can get scholarship money for to help you go to college. And he said, I'll make you a deal. He goes, I'll give you a couple breeder pigs and you can grow your own herd and make your own money to go to college. And I'll do that in exchange for you basically doing all the chores on this farm. Or he said, you don't have to do that. You can stay here until September 1 following your graduation from high school. And if you stay here after that, here's your rent payment. Or you can go get an apartment in a neighboring town. In other words, I think he was trying to tell me your better choice is to take my first offer, the first option.
Why do you think it was breeder pigs? Why do you think it was that specific thing?
Well, at the time, I had actually started my own 4-H pig-related club.
Cool.
Because pigs at the time in Central Oregon were not a big deal, and I was passionate about them because I had raised several years prior in a 4-H club, and I had sold them in the auction and made really good money. And so I always thought this is a great opportunity to make some good money. And I just like pigs. They're one of the most dirtiest but most intelligent animals that I had ever been around. So He had already started a pig farm, and so that was his way of his method of giving me a starter kit, if you want to call it that. And so I took advantage of that. And fortunately, I grew up in an era and in a location and in a home where the only device we had was a 12-inch black and white TV with rabbit ears, three stations available. And at the time, it was a lot of stuff that as a youngster, you don't watch. And so I applied myself to studying. I was the unofficial keeper of the World Book Encyclopedia collection we had, and I studied every night, and I read books like the encyclopedias when I didn't have homework. And so I ultimately became an honor society student. I ultimately raised enough money to go to college and learned really the business side of things through that process. And got into college and gave it a good go for 3 years. At the time, while in college, I was working at night in a rubber manufacturing plant too. And I realized that what they're trying to teach me, I've already learned. It just wasn't in such fancy terms. And it was a private college I went to. And so I quit after 3 years. And that's really when I kind of launched into my full manufacturing career from there. But in that experience, I took advantage of my time. I was not a big partier. I was more interested in playing football, which I did. And so happens this program I played for, I think they just achieved their 87th straight winning season in a row, which is more than any other college football program at any level or any other college athletic program at all. And so there was that influence on me of being a part of that team that kind of really established how you win and a desire to win.
Cool. I think right now I hear a lot about there's this conversation of, you know, school is not the thing. Right. If you can find a mentor or someone who sees your potential and can take you under their wing, that is a way faster track and more efficient track. It's just how do you do that? How do you get there? So that's really interesting to hear that you kind of, how long ago? So 40, 50, we won't go there. A while ago.
It was about 40 years ago.
Yes. Uh-huh. That you already figured that out, you know, that, right. And I'm sure college was the thing, you know, everyone wanted to go to college.
Yep.
And you got the fast track through business. So, which is really cool.
I did. And I have to thank you for this opportunity because it kind of allowed me to, in retrospect, kind of review my life. And I always try to come up with a why, and I try to find relevant things that have either been said to me or that I've read that I can apply to those experiences. And so when I had the chance to really think about what did that feel like when I was 12 years old, I go back to the JFK speech where he said, "We're going to put a man on the moon." We'd never been to the moon. We'd been in space once, but we didn't know how to put a man on the moon and bring him safely back to Earth. So because I've studied a lot of leadership and I looked at a lot of speeches that moved societies, this is when I went back on and read about the entire speech. And though I know my dad didn't have this intent, he kind of did. What I mean by that is if you read the speech of JFK, he's really saying that we're doing it because it's hard. It's going to test our skills and ability to organize ourselves in a way to win. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's trying to motivate a society to back that effort, which happened. And so I always looked at that, I want you to go to college, but I'm not paying for it, as that you're going to go to the moon and back. You need to figure it out.
Yeah.
Beautiful lesson.
Yeah. How do you, I just have to ask, how do you feel about your dad? Like, thinking about that plan, like, that's like a really genius plan. I wonder if he knew how smart it was.
Well, I didn't learn until later, like a few years ago. My dad actually served in the Korean War as a field medic. He volunteered. He went in the Navy when he was 17, to become a dentist. Korean War broke out, and he volunteered to be a field medic, which means you go on the battlefield without any form of protection at all. No weapon, no knife, no nothing. And in talking to one of his close buddies, you know, my dad experienced some things because of that, that environment, that I think helped him become who he was as a dad.
Yeah.
And so for him, having to get up at 4 a.m. every morning at 15 below zero and go break the ice in the water and feed the pigs, whether you feel like it or not, that was just something you did. And so I think he saw this challenge as something that he wanted to give me.
Yeah.
That he didn't give my other two brothers. And so I feel very fortunate for that.
Ah, I love that.
And I'm glad I didn't know what his past was until later on, because I think it would have changed my perception of him.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So we have to speed up time.
Yep.
Let's get into, because I know you had an opportunity to study at Harvard, and it was an executive program.
I did.
And we have to cover that briefly. And we also need to cover, you worked with Jack Welch.
I did.
And tell us who Jack Welch is. We need to take us like warp speed through.
So are you saying I'm too much of a storyteller? It's possible.
There's too much I have to ask you.
Okay. So part of a succession plan was my development. And part of that development effort was sending me to, I think it was a 12-week course. I totally had to leave my job, still employed, but couldn't focus on my job while I was there. The class was made up of 37 different countries, all president and above. And what I walked away from there was the ability to talk about a single subject from 37 or more different views without it being an argument. And I learned a lot by accepting other views. And for me, that was the biggest takeaway. It was then I met Jack Welch for the first time, who I think was there giving a speech on the risk of online schools taking over the traditional.
The risk.
Okay. So fast forward, the company, the corporation I was with, we became part owners with, or they became part owners with us, a private equity group that Jack Welch was a principal of.
And you say, who is Jack Welch?
Jack Welch. Jack Welch used to run General Electric, and became very popular for his turnaround or growth results, and became a very good, you know, leader of management and a good teacher of both leadership and proper management. And he was important to me because he was an engineer and came through the manufacturing sector. And so anyway, met Jack again through that process, had the opportunity to go through quarterly reviews in a very tall Manhattan skyscraper with a conference table that was about 100 yards long. And there's Jack with his little attaché case or briefcase that he's got a pet name for it. But It really didn't sink in until after the first maybe two quarterly reviews. But Jack is about as savvy as they get. Now, your first meeting is about what do you look like and how pretty is your presentation. He kind of let you go through that. And I got into my second or third one, and he flips right to the appendix page 17, which you believe nobody looks at. And he goes, why are your 20 basis points up here? Well, naturally, it was in the appendix. You don't prepare for those answers. And my takeaway from that was, I don't care what level of data it is or what level of detail it is of the business you're running, you better know it.
Yeah.
And so had a few more opportunities to interact with Jack again at Harvard Business School. Like, I was sent there as part of my development. I sent one of my people there and went to visit them one day, and I didn't know Jack was going to be there, and he was there speaking, and he spotted me in the audience, and he was talking about creating this clear line of sight for your organization towards the objectives you want to meet as a business. And he actually called out, you know, clear line of sight I had created for my business. And so I really felt acknowledged and affirmation and all those great things that here's this icon that A, remembers who I am, and B, you know, really supported what I was up to.
Wow, what a cool moment.
It was great.
Very cool.
So that was my experience with both.
So at what point did you become really invested in the pursuit of and have this growing interest in becoming a great leader, what that entails?
You know, that's a really great question. It's probably when I spent the most time on thinking about, and I always naturally felt like a leader, whatever that meant.
Yeah.
I read a lot of books on it, but something just wasn't complete with me until about 2010, when I had, again, as part of my succession development, I went into a leadership course through JMW Consultants, which really kind of rocked my world. And what I mean by that is, for the first time, somebody was able to help me identify who I was being as a person and how those characteristics either helped or hurt me in my leadership from day to day. And so I accepted those changes and kind of went forward with the belief, now with the knowledge of who I'm being. And I got to say this, there's a couple of things. I used to be so shy, I couldn't even talk to myself. And
what, from kid to when?
To probably about the time I was in my 40s, I was really insecure about talking to somebody. I did a lot of observing. I did a lot of listening, of course. And so I don't look negatively on that. I look at it as a good thing. Because I was always trying to pick apart my boss's boss and figure out what worked, what didn't work. But the other part of it is that you could probably compare me to one of those Easter Island statues. I had the look and the emotional range of an Easter Island statue. And so I learned that I was sometimes pushing people away. I was intimidating them because of the way I looked or the way I was being with them in words and actions.
Yeah, it's actually, well, and I've found, because I have some of those in my life, some Easter Island statues. They're incredibly smart, though.
They are.
There's a lot going on in there, too. So there's a lot of observation. And so, yeah, that's probably a benefit to that, those qualities, too, is you're always processing and thinking. And
yep.
So what is your, I guess, do you have like a leadership manifesto or what is your mindset going into the day as a leader? What is there kind of some things that you always have in the back of your mind is going into this day? I have it right now. You have a team of 27. You said, how do you show up for them? What are kind of those core?
Well, it's not just who I work with at my business. I go about my day with this mindset. Number one is I get paid for results. As a leader, I have to accept that's why I do what I do. And that can be financial or it can be on several other fronts. And so I had to make a decision at some point where I had to really fine-tune what my objective was as a leader. And it was part of this process with JMW Consultants where I arrived at, how do you define leadership? It's not management to me. Management is just kind of managing or shepherding the status quo. leadership to me is causing something to happen that isn't happening today. In other words, causing what isn't is my slogan. And from there, then it became this journey of how do I effectively take my discontent for the status quo and do something constructive with that. That, when I finally came to that realization of what I needed to do differently, then I was able to find myself in conversations that really move things forward rather than just griping about what is so or what something is today. Mm-hmm. So I'm naturally in this mode of looking for improvement, whether it's in a process, a piece of equipment, but more importantly, a person.
Right. I was going to say, how do you take, I guess, for people who maybe have a hard time getting out of the, you know, I'm fixing a problem, but I'm going to fix it, right? Versus I'm going to find the person that can fix it. I'm going to help them and help them have the resources. How do you make that like, how do you go from one to the other? Because I feel like that's a big step in growing as a, finally, like starting to become a real leader.
Well, for me, I was one of those. I fixed it all myself, and I wore myself out physically and emotionally doing that. When I discovered that, when I was open with those who I was working with, and it didn't matter at what level, and I was very open about what our objectives are, and I helped to make it crystal clear what each level or each person the organization did in support of those objectives. I then found myself in these conversations that were a little more meaningful to why are we here today? And that then kind of opened up these other possibilities of me sharing more, being more transparent, being more real with the people I was working with. And we're part of these teams that moved mountains in a lot of cases. And from there, then it just became a process of continually nurturing and feeding their, meaning the people's, the person's requirements to go to the next level. When I finally broke everything down in simple terms, operating a business for me was about three pillars. It's people, it's processes, and it's technology, which includes equipment. And for decades, we've put so much focus and time into the processes and the equipment and technology, forgot about the people.
Speaking our language.
These other two don't work at all. Unless you've got people that are engaged and are properly trained and given the proper equipment to do the job you're asking to do.
It's literally the core of what our team talks about all the time is you can hire people to help you all day with process, right?
Right.
And that's what they'll focus on. But the people, what do you do without people
right.
that are engaged in there? So I want to ask you then too, what advice would you give to leaders who are maybe feeling like they have a lot of weight on them? There are a lot of problems that need to be fixed and they're in firefighting mode all the time. What advice do you give that manufacturing leader?
Well, what I tell myself when I find myself in those situations is two things. One is anyone can hold the helm when the seas are calm. And that's relating to a ship captain. My mother would always say, "You'll survive," as she's digging a rock out of my knee because of a bike wreck. It just was
classic.
So yeah, so those things. But no, more seriously, it really comes down to you're not alone. You're not alone. Never quit, because quitting can become a habit you don't want. And what those two things said, then it's learn how to reach out to talk about and seek help from those that can really help. In my experience, I fought a lot of fires and I'm fighting one now. And my benefit has been with Impact Utah, Manufacturers Extension Project, other people that I trust that I know have been there raised your hand, call them up on the phone and just have a chat. And it's amazed me how many people want to help, and they give you the right resources or suggestions to kind of help you feel better about where you are.
Yeah. Okay. I have to applaud Clean Machine for a minute, because I went to UMA's Safety Awards by the time this actually comes out, it'll be a couple months ago, but you guys won an award, and I wanted to ask you, like, and you said you haven't had an incident, a safety incident, since 2021.
It's been over 900 days.
Wow. How have you managed that?
Well, we have a byline. We show up every work and we strive for being complete on time every time. And so it's not just about safety I'm going to talk about here. Safety performance is a result of us making sure that we are performing to every customer's specifications, that we are doing safety training every week, that our shop is set up in a way to where if OSHA were to walk in, they wouldn't find anything. And our employees are involved in those processes. And so because we chose our charge is to be complete on time every time, we have that safety record. We're operating now at about a 98% quality rating with our customers. We've taken our on-time deliveries from 55% up to about 85%. So it's a total culture we have that I don't care what you measure. It's not perfect all the time,
but
we just go about our day doing things right.
I've also heard that you, and I need to come in and see your facility someday, but you live up to your name, Clean Machine. I've heard you have the cleanest machine shop that anyone's ever seen, which is huge props to you, your whole team. That's really hard to do. I've seen a number of smaller machine shops, and you know, it's all over the spectrum. So it's huge.
Well, there's a good reason for that. Part of it is just, you know, it's who we are and what we do every day. And part of achieving the results we do is this complete mindset of being organized and being clean in this case. I've had some very large corporations in that have said the same thing, that this is the cleanest machine shop I have ever been in. The other reason for it is my attempt to change the perception of what manufacturing is today. It's not that dark, dirty, cold, hot, sweaty plant that we've all been in before. It's temperature controlled, it's clean, it's quiet, it's a lot of nice things. And that really, to me, typifies what modern manufacturing is.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about your workforce focus and how that came about. Because we all know in manufacturing, it's a real issue trying to get people, talented people, skilled people into these jobs. And in Utah, it's particularly difficult. What solutions are you helping? Because I know you're directly involved and have actually brought some up and said, why don't we do this? And what does that look like? Tell us about that.
Well, there's a burning platform for me, and it all starts with having to be in a position to effectively make a manufacturing company successful. And throughout the decades, especially since the last two or three decades, when public schools stopped funding vocational programs, those opportunities for kids to learn jobs that are hands-on type jobs, that opportunity wasn't there for them. So the schools then became more focused on how many kids can we get to college? Well, that's created its own set of issues and challenges for them and society. But I felt like there's an opportunity that if business could just lead education to a greater degree than we have, we can change this outcome. The outcome is we have kids coming out of high school that don't know what they want to do. They have an education that's probably irrelevant for most things that they should be doing to earn a living and become a contributing adult to society. And so my dream is to start promoting today's manufacturing and tomorrow's technology as low as kindergarten. So then by the time you're in junior high, you can pick a track of what you want to go into. In this case, it could be manufacturing, which includes engineering and, you know, some other professional type skills. But the majority of it would be what do we need in shop? So the biggest effort there for me is getting other employers to be able to define what that is, working with education to agree upon what is relevant curriculum in junior high and high school. Get a kid to, you know, pick a track, something that they're interested in, and then start being able to provide a learning situation that helps each individual achieve those necessary skills. Now, when I say that, what I'm talking about is apprenticeship programs, more hands-on type learning experience versus the classroom stuff. I think we're going to get there in the state of Utah. And I'm really excited about it. And I know the right people are working on it. I can't say anything more than that right now, but we're going to get there.
You're making me excited because I mean, as a mom, I have a 7-year-old, 5-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And kind of taking it full circle back to the beginning of the conversation, I want my kids to know that college is an option, right? And I want them to do exactly what they want. But I want them to get the full spectrum. And I don't feel like I didn't grow up really seeing the full spectrum. I felt like, go to college.
Right.
So the fact that there's work being done so they can really discover early on more and not be like, you know, question in the final hour when it's time to get a job. Like, I don't even know what I like. What do I do here?
Right.
It's amazing. So I appreciate, as a parent, I appreciate that. We have to wrap up, but I have to ask you, because you've had such an incredible career, what is there one, a transformative moment for you personally in your career? So I want to know that, but I also want to know, of all the things you've done, what are you most proud of?
Well, the answer is going to hopefully answer both. And okay. It, in general, it boils down to the people that chose to be a part of something bigger than themselves and then took that experience to become somebody or something that they never believed they could be. That to me is fascinating.
And watching that happen with the people around you.
Exactly.
Awesome. Is there some, like, a specific instance you can recall or person? Not that you don't have to call anyone out, but.
Well, I call it the boardroom. Think Memphis, Tennessee, still very segregated, in my opinion. Turned around a plant that was on President's Island, which historically was a penal colony for black criminals. And this plant I took over, I was the only white person. Now, I'm going to stop right there and say I've learned to not look at color. It doesn't matter to me, but for most of the audience, I have to identify there's those things at play there that are not easy sometimes to deal with. And so to make a long story short, took this plant and a couple of the individuals there that didn't believe they could be really anything more than what they were than when I met them. And we took this plant from being the worst performing plant in our entire corporation to winning safety awards on a national level, quality awards on a national level, won a bunch of customers back and earned a lot more customers through that process. So they became profitably one of the better performing plants in the corporation. And through that effort, it was the growth of a couple of people, like I said, that didn't think they could be who they become eventually. One day I was in a lunchroom with them in the shop, and they were asking me what my schedule was for the next week. And I said, well, I have to go to a board meeting. And one of them said, well, I wish we were as important as board members. And I said, you know what? You're more important. One day you'll be sitting in a boardroom. These are the things we have to do. I laid out the clarity or the line of sight of this is what we have to do to get there. So fast forward about 4 years, I had taken that opportunity and brought somebody else up in to finish it off. And I moved on to another problem child. And this person called me, who we eventually established as the new plant manager of this plant. And he said, I'd like you to stop by if you're ever in the area. And so I told him I'm in Little Rock. I'll come by tomorrow when I'm on my way through, and stopped in. And we greeted, and he showed me this building that he had converted, what was one time the white guy's, you know, the boss's office building with the administration staff. And he had moved every employee out to the shop because he believed that's where they could be most helpful and effective. And he converted this building to a training center. And on one end of it, where my office used to be, he converted it to a boardroom. Awesome. He goes, we got our boardroom.
Awesome. Brad, thank you so much for sharing your life, your stories. I feel like we're incredibly fortunate to have you in Utah and be able to learn from you. So thank you so much.
Thank you.